Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. As part of our Smithsonian Associates Partnership Program, our guest today, Dr. Cindy Otto, is the leading expert on working dogs, training those dogs to do amazing things, but almost more importantly, connecting human and dog on a very special level.
That connection between dogs and people is so powerful and has such a potential to heal that I am driven to really try and augment that relationship and make sure that we have dogs that are performing in the best, safest, healthiest way and working with people, and we save each other in that situation. The dogs can physically save us. They can also emotionally save us. And we, by providing that care and the appropriate training and the opportunity for them to be successful, can save them as well.
That, of course, is our guest today, Dr. Cindy Otto, who will be appearing at the Smithsonian Associates Program June 4th, 2017, Washington, D.C., at the Ripley Center, presenting on the subject, Working Dogs, Saviors in the Post-9/11 World. This is a special interview. The Not Old Better Show audience loves our pets. This is a special interview. The Not Old Better audience loves our pets. And this interview is special to me because as an avowed dog person and dog lover, Dr. Otto is an avowed dog lover and does amazing work with them. And special because of what Dr. Otto's work has resulted in. The disease detection work done by dogs. The search and rescue work done by dogs. And the amazing insights into what dogs do when present on scene to buoy spirits and boost human emotion. Brilliant work by Dr. Otto. Dr. Cindy Otto is a fascinating guest, and I'm certain you'll love this interview. But special news flash and announcement, Sunday, June 4th, the presentation by Dr. Otto is sold out. But you can get on the waiting list by dialing 202-633-3030. That's 202-633-3030. I'll put links up for all the information about the waiting list, as well as Dr. Otto's stellar bio and professional details. And in the meantime, enjoy this interview. And please join me in welcoming Dr. Cindy Otto to the Not Old Better Show, Smithsonian Associates Art of Living Series. So, Dr. Cindy Otto, please know that it is a thrill to talk to you, and it's going to be a thrill to see you, hear from you at the Smithsonian Associates Program, Sunday, June 4th, 2017 at the Ripley Center. I wonder if we could start with just a brief self-introduction, as well as touch on what you're going to be talking about at the Smithsonian Associates presentation on June 4th.
Sure, absolutely. So my career started as a veterinarian in emergency medicine. I was drawn to emergency medicine and really kind of fell in love with the excitement and the thrill, but I also had the opportunity to be introduced to search and rescue dogs. And that gave me a whole new perspective of how I could serve dogs and people as a veterinarian. As a result of that, I became involved with the Pennsylvania Urban Search and Rescue Task Force 1, where it was a national task force that responded to national disasters. And I was privileged enough to be able to respond to Hurricane Floyd with the team, and then in 2001 responded to the World Trade Center. It was that experience that really opened my eyes to the impact and the importance of these dogs and the role that they play and the interaction that we have. So I'm going to share some of the stories of the dogs from 9/11 that inspired me to kind of take this to a next level. And really, because I am a researcher and a scientist and an academic veterinarian as well as a practicing veterinarian, I really wanted to bring science into the realm of these working dogs. How can we make sure that the dogs are working at their optimal level? what is the best dog for this type of work? What are the physical characteristics that we need to make sure that we are providing for these dogs or selecting for? What is the training that is best for the dogs and their different disciplines? And what about the genetics? What about, you know, all of these different aspects? And so as a result of the work with the dogs at Ground Zero and 15 years of following their health and behavior afterwards, we opened the center, the Penn Vet Working Dog Center, which is a research and development center for detection dogs, so that we could begin to answer some of those questions.
And some of those questions do center on the science of smell. We all know that dogs have a tremendous sense of smell, but even at a cellular level, when a cancer cell changes, a dog might be able to discern that change or maybe detect a melanoma or other cancer. And finding human life amidst the rubble at 9/11, because that's got to be a very memorable part of your career, and we're looking forward to hearing more about that. I wonder if you could tell us a story from that time there at 9/11 about what you watched the dogs do and how they did it and what really you learned from that, because that's been 15 years ago now.
Yeah, it seems so recent and then so far in the past. And it was really life-changing to watch what these dogs were able to do despite all of the conditions. And really what they did was they kept working. They kept searching. And most of the dogs that came were part of these urban search and rescue task forces, but there were a number that came from police departments. There were some that came from different search and rescue teams. And several of these dogs, probably about half of these dogs, had been trained not only to find live humans, but also to find human remains. It turned out that that was a really important component of their job when we were at Ground Zero, because there was, you know, one person that was found live, and they think that a dog might have been involved in that alert. But for the rest of the, you know, 300 or so dogs that were there, really they didn't find what they came to find. And that was really hard on the people. It was hard on the dogs in that they were trying to play a game where they get a reward when they find what they've been trained to find, and they were not getting their reward. They, you know, we like to think that they were sad, but they probably weren't sad about the situation. We think that they really just kind of found it not very rewarding to keep working and not, you know, not find anything. So just search and search. It's a little bit like playing the slot machine and keep putting in quarters and not ever winning anything. So there's a couple things that happened. One, the handlers being very attuned and really knowing their dogs would set up little mock searches so that there could be a little bit of a win in a game and the dogs could go, oh, okay, there is a possibility that this is actually going to pay off. The other thing, and that was so interesting, is even the dogs that had never been trained to find human remains started to what we call show interest. So they didn't do their typical bark alert, but if they came across some human remains, they started to respond to it differently than all of the other debris and rubble. And that became really critical for allowing, you know, those remains to be recovered.
In addition to the work that the dogs were doing there on the site, just the sheer effort that they were expending alongside the humans, I've heard you talk a little bit about another component that the dogs offered, and that was kind of as man's best friend. It's hard to, I think I've heard you say, it's hard to look at a dog and not smile. And so the dogs really represented this sense of kind of uplift, of maybe some emotional kind of support that was going on between dog and man.
Absolutely, and it was a huge, huge role. There were, I don't know, probably 600 therapy dogs that were on the periphery and providing great services. But what we found is that on the site at Ground Zero, when we had so many first responders and volunteers there working just just constantly and feeling the weight of the world. Just it was such a heavy, sad place. It was, you know, there was no positive emotion except for when they'd catch a glimpse of a dog, except for when they had a chance to maybe, you know, pet a dog for just a second and a little sort of crack of light came in. It was a hope, a joy, a memory that, you know, when there's dogs around, somehow things can't always be that bad, that there's something out there that's going to, you know, turn things around.
We're with Dr. Cindy Otto. Dr. Otto is responsible for training dogs for detection work. And this training, Dr. Otto, I find it fascinating. I'm a dog person, and I've trained Rottweilers for obedience work and familiarity with my family. And so I know what goes into it. But as I understand it, you're starting these dogs pretty early, maybe as puppies, 11 to 15 weeks of age. Do you ever find that puppies at that age are just so darn cute that trainers might overlook, you know, some of the errant behavior because they just see in front of them an adorable puppy?
The puppies definitely grab our hearts. Mm-hmm. And they actually start at 8 weeks of age. Oh, so they are ridiculously cute.
Right.
But you know, some of what we have and some of what we allow, you know, because we're not really as focused on the obedience as we are focused on their noses. Mm. So sometimes they do get away with a little bit of stuff. But mostly because everything we do with them is just a big happy game, we can just have fun and they can make us laugh and smile and just really make our day by doing the things that advance their career and kind of move things along. So we just hoot and holler when they, you know, find somebody who's hiding behind a little cardboard barrier, when they start to take a sniff of something that we're trying to teach them to sniff. It's just so filled with joy. But even the little things like them sitting in their crate before we open the door so that they're not bolting out, you know, that becomes a party and a joy. And so, you know, the fact that we associate all of the behaviors that we want with fun and good things, it makes us all happy.
Among these behaviors, what are the temperaments that you're looking for that you then are, you know, developing for these dogs?
So we really want persistence. So we want a dog that is, particularly when they're using their nose, is going to hunt with their nose and hunt and hunt and hunt and hunt until they find what it is that they're looking for, whether that's a toy or whether it's actually something more specific that we've trained them on. We want them to just really want to seek that out. We also like dogs that are a little bit on the more independent side. So if we were to throw a toy in some tall grass, the dog would go out and it would look for it. And it wouldn't look back at us to like go, hey, which way did it go? Can you give me a direction? We're really wanting the dog that is like, I'm on this. I can do this. I really, you know, I don't really need your help. Yeah, it's great to work with you, but I don't need you to hold my paw. So, you know, that's something that we're looking for. Depending on the career, we're looking for some agility and strength and bravery, but some of our dogs don't have that, and those are not the dogs that are going to be the search and rescue dogs, because our search and rescue dogs are those brave and bold and, you know, leap gazelle like across all sorts of collapsed buildings and rubble. But some of our dogs don't meet that. But luckily in our program, because we allow the dogs to, what we say, declare their major, they can tell us what they're good at, what they enjoy, and what they do well. So that's why some of our dogs are cancer detection dogs, because they feel more comfortable and they really actually thrive walking around a scent wheel and telling us, you know, yep, this one's got the odor, nope, that one doesn't. And they think that's the best game in the world.
Dogs and this idea of detection, it's becoming a lot more widely used. Is that proving to be a difficult part of your job in finding these dogs that are just suited for this kind of work? Is there a shortage of these type of animals?
Oh, that's a great question, and there absolutely is a shortage. And the shortage is for a couple of reasons. We know that there is a huge shortage of dogs for the military, for the police, dogs that are able to do what we call dual-purpose work. And part of that is because probably about 90% of those dogs have come from Eastern Europe. And there is such a huge demand for police and working dogs across the world that the dogs that used to be sort of the top dogs that the U.S. was able to purchase, they're no longer available for the U.S. because there are the highest bidder usually will get those dogs. And it seems, based on talking to people in the military and in the police world, that there has been a decrease in the quality of the dogs. And in some ways that makes sense, because there's such a demand that people are willing to be less careful in their breeding. And so that's a big issue that we, you know, have to be thinking about. And one of our goals is to help develop a national breeding cooperative here in this country so that we can rely on domestically bred and raised dogs to meet that incredible need, particularly for national security, but all across the board. And the other side of the shortage is that there are more and more jobs for detection dogs. So people are looking for dogs for bed bug detection. They're looking for dogs for search and rescue. They're looking for dogs for explosives, for narcotics detection. You know, the list goes on and on and on. And so the more people who are really looking to have dogs that have the particular personality, the skills, the traits that make them good detection dogs, you know, it makes the pool, again, smaller. So we really need to be thinking about how do we meet these demands and provide the resources and really specifically select for dogs that are really excellent at this and dedicated to this type of work.
Dr. Otto, among the praise and accolades of your work, one honor really jumped out at me, and that's the award that you received from the Kennel Club of Philadelphia, naming you as dog's best friend. I just think that what a wonderful honor that is to be their best friend. So tell us a little bit about what that award focuses on and what part of your work is the Kennel Club rewarding?
You know, I think that it is just one of the most wonderful, sort of heartwarming. It just made me feel warm even for you to describe that. And I think a lot of the work that they have, you know, focused on is about 9/11. And, you know, the AKC Canine Health Foundation has funded a study where for 15 years we followed the health and the behavior of the dogs that worked at 9/11, looking for any kind of medical or behavioral changes that resulted from that experience. We've analyzed the data sort of in the preliminary version, and in the end, what we found is that the dogs really didn't have any adverse effects that we could measure associated with their work. We looked at longevity, and search and rescue dogs, they live to be really old, which is wonderful. And that's, I think, one of the cool things that I don't know if we can prove, but it feels like those dogs, they have a job. They are more likely to be physically fit. They have an incredible relationship with their handler. I think that's really good for them, for their quality of life, for their longevity.
That's fascinating, because you might think that just as the humans were wearing masks and maybe their susceptibility to cancers might have been on the rise as a result of the work there at Ground Zero, that the same would be true for dogs. It makes me think, these dogs that are in these settings, whether it's the detection kind of setting or a combat setting, are they offered some of the same protections that humans are? Are they wearing masks or goggles? Or what about bomb sniffing dog? Are they protected by a flak jacket and some of the suits that the humans are wearing?
Yeah, so it's really an interesting question, and there are some goggles out there for dogs, and those are actually probably the easiest for the dogs to learn to wear and to use effectively. There are some pictures from the historic records of dogs wearing what look like gas masks, but the challenge that we have with putting any kind of respiratory protection on a dog, it's a couple of things. First of all, they have to sniff in order to do their job. So it makes it a little harder if they've got a mask on. But more importantly, they don't sweat. And in order for them to cool off, particularly when they're working hard, they have to pant. And if they have a mask on, that panting is going to really be interfered with. It's going to make it harder for them to get rid of heat, and they're going to be more prone to overheating. So there really hasn't been anything that's been developed. And I think given some of our results from our study, it's probably not as much of a priority. I think dogs probably with their nasal passages and that their filtering ability and just some of the difference in their physiology, they don't seem to be at as much risk as humans with our very short noses. We are more likely to absorb some of those toxins in ways that dogs seem to, at least from our data, be more resistant or resilient with. So I think that's an area that we're probably not going to jump into quickly. As far as bulletproof vests and flak jacket type things, there are those out there. There are a number of police dogs that have those. The challenge, again, is they're heavy. They add heat because they're just holding in the heat in the dog's body. And so people use them, but probably not as extensively. So, trying to find what that best protection is. But definitely, if you look at some of these dogs that are part of the advanced teams, like the Navy SEAL teams, and they have all sorts of gadgets and gizmos. But respiratory protection really hasn't been one of the areas that we've been successful in creating something that allows them to safely do their job.
Does your research show, maybe even anecdotally, whether dogs have a need to be purpose-driven? Is that what's driving them in this?
I don't know that they need purpose. I think they need to be, I think of dogs as being cheaters and selfish. They want to have fun. And they'll do what it is to have fun. Now, defining what fun is for each dog is obviously a little different. And that's why we're specifically looking at different breeding selection for dogs that find it just absolutely so much fun to search for something or chase a ball or the things that make it fun, and we find that there is a genetic component to that. We know that hunting dogs have been bred for centuries because that's what they love to do, and sort of making that just part of their internal fabric is really helpful to be able to have these kind of dogs do the jobs that we're asking them to do.
Dr. Cindy Otto, you're going to be appearing at the Smithsonian Associates Sunday, June 4th, 2017 at the Ripley Center. This has been just a wonderful conversation. Your work is so interesting and important. What a pleasure it is to talk to you. It's just going to be a pleasure to hear from you and see you there at the Smithsonian Associates. Thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I just love talking about the dogs.
I could talk to you for several more hours, too, Dr. Otto. Thank you so much, and we'll see you on Sunday, June 4th.
All right. Thanks, Paul, so much.
Thanks, Dr. Otto. Bye-bye.
Bye.